Hello, everyone, and welcome to Griplock Foundation Disc Golf's weekly podcast. I'm Hunter, joined, as always, by Trevor, and we've got some new stuff. We basically have a whole new podcast. Not really, but I've got a new mic that you're hearing me through. You can probably tell the difference.
I practically smiled listening to your intro. That it sounded so good.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds drastically better. So huge shout out to, actually, I won't put his name in because he probably wouldn't want me to, but someone in the Foundation Nation gave us this mic. He had it, and he said he just didn't want it anymore. He said it would be better used on our podcast. So huge shout out to him. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, the using this mic and mixing it in. We just got it today. So super excited about that. And we also got a new camera that we're using right now. There's a chance it's going to die because we didn't get to fully charge the battery. So there's a chance it might die during this. We have to switch to a different camera, but we're going to have our fingers crossed that that doesn't happen. And we have a pretty great show.
I think so.
At least in my opinion.
Yeah, we got some good stuff.
We have the first topic we're going to be talking about is inspired by a Brody Smith tweet, which if you don't follow Brody on Twitter, you know that he is very vocal about his opinions when it comes to the disc golf world and things that we could do differently or, in his opinion, better. And the majority of them are geared towards the Pro Tour. So this one is going to be about the Pro Tour specifically in the fact of implementing cuts on the Pro Tour.
Right.
Should we do it? How should we go about doing it? And all of that. So first off, I want your just straight up opinion before we get into facts or statistics or anything like that. Are cuts good at the top level of sport?
Yes.
Okay, now why?
I mean, there's reasons that they're implemented. Like obviously the PGA is like the example, you know, for cuts in golf. And the reason the PGA, and we looked this up a bit and kind of looked into it, because like you're just kind of like, I grew up seeing, knowing that there was cuts in like professional ball golf, so like I just kind of accepted it. But like there is reasoning. They implement the cut after the first two rounds in a four-round tournament, and it's to basically lighten the field so there's more flexibility. They can have the players play in twosomes instead of threesomes, which disc golf that would translate a bit differently. But
yeah, so disc golf they couldn't do.
They're lightening the groups. Less waiting in between shots. They're also allowing players to, since the course isn't so packed, they can let players sleep in a bit. You don't have to have as many early tee times. And you can also have your leading players, you can really be selective with the time they're teeing off and playing in that prime afternoon slot. You can have them, you know, that be more selective. So that is the reasons for a cut. I think in disc golf, those are all great reasons. But I think in disc golf, there's an even better reason to have them, and that's because right now there's no qualifying process to play on the Pro Tour. So this gets irrelevant players out of the field before the last couple of days because there's no point in them being there.
Interesting. So the biggest argument I've seen against this,
or
right?
Relevant players, I mean, good players can get cut too. That's just part of the game.
I think the biggest argument that I've seen against this is the like basically that it's going to discourage people from playing on the Pro Tour. That lower half of the field, right. Why are they going to want to show up? And they are the ones that donate to the purse. Now, before we get into a lot of this, I do want to mention that, and I want to get your opinion on this a little bit too. Personally, I don't think that FPO is ready for cuts in disc golf.
I was going to say,
I think the field needs time to grow. I do think that MPO is getting to the point that we can at least consider it.
Right.
And talk through it and see kind of, are we there? But I do want to at least address the fact of the matter that we would be missing out, you know. I think local pros would still show up because it's your local tournament. Right. You're still going to pay even though you might only be playing two rounds. But you would kind of miss out on those players that are kind of barely scraping by on tour, but they're on tour right now. I could see a lot of those players quitting simply because of the fact that now if I'm not cashing, I think that one thing is where the cut line would be, but if I'm not cashing, essentially, I might not only get to play two rounds.
There's definitely a line to walk in the sport where, like, we want the sport to be, I think the sport needs to be more cutthroat because it's going to motivate players to rise up the ranks. And what could happen is you have these players that would probably be sitting around the cut line who really aren't Let's say your cut line players, like the guys that are average, like they can make cuts, but they aren't really doing anything. Let's say they're not really practicing a lot. They're kind of just sitting there. And let's say they start practicing because they're like, oh, we got to be able to make cuts. And they realize they can get a lot better.
That those players aren't working hard right now.
I'm just saying that could be something that happens. Like we could see.
I think that that could. I think that's a select few because I think there's some people that are peaking just below the cut line.
Well, yeah, I completely agree with that. I'm just saying it. That's just possible. Like that's one of the reasons I think disc golf needs to become more cutthroat is to motivate players that are just kind of sitting. And a lot of these players are like guys that are sitting in like the 10 to 15, 10 to 20 slot that are kind of just sitting there.
Well, they'd still be in the cut.
Yeah, but they could miss cuts.
That's also true.
Those guys that are like names that could miss cuts, that would be detrimental.
The biggest question that the Pro Tour has to answer before even thinking about implementing this is how exactly does this benefit the tour and help grow the sport? Like, what exactly is this doing to accomplish both of those things? Now, to me, I think the biggest thing would be the faster-paced rounds that would help with the live coverage. Right. And it would allow people to go to threesomes, which would help with the faster-paced rounds. That would change up, you know, our current way we perceive disc golf and watch disc golf in, you know, foursomes. That's just what disc golf is. But cutting the field would allow it to go to threesomes, which would allow it to be faster. And it would also cut kind of the dead weight, if you want to call it that, of the lower half of the field that might be causing some of these backups at, like, say, a Northwoods Gold type of a situation that we got into at Ledgestone. So it would remove some of that. But, you know, one question is, are those benefits worth the repercussions of losing, let's just say, I mean, in my opinion, I think it would be like around 20% of the field wouldn't show up if there was a cut.
Well, that's the thing. Like
in a tournament that could be 20 to 30 players, is the benefit of faster tee time or faster rounds, playing in threesomes, less backups, whatever else it could bring, you know, being a more prestigious tour, if you want to call it that, adding legitimacy, is all of that worth losing 20 to 30 players? Yeah,
and it is true that they will lose players because, like, obviously on the PGA Tour, like, implementing cuts, that's not going to affect players because there's such a massive, like, ball golf is so much bigger that, like, there are an infinite amount of really talented guys ready to step into those slots.
Yeah.
Ball or disc golf, because our pool of talent isn't there yet. Now it's really starting to boom and it's going to be getting there. But because it's not there, players, it's pretty easy to assume that there's going to be less players in the field. So then the only question, I don't think that does anything as far as like spectating or like following the tournament because eyes aren't on those guys anyways. The eyes are on the top pros. So it only matters as far as money. That's what it comes down to. And I know you have the details and what we've kind of decided is it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah. So, you know, I asked the question of like how in turn, like obviously how does it help the tour, but also how does it hurt the tour?
Right.
The number one argument I saw in response to Brody's tweet specifically was the purse. Because, you know, those players who would be cut from the cut line are typically the ones you see as donators.
Right.
So I was like, well, is that actually true? Do those players actually make up enough of the purse that cutting them would hurt the players who are cashing?
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at it. Idlewild had 132 players in the MPO field. Again, we're not looking at FPO because I don't think they're worth, or not worth, that's the bad word. I don't think that they are ready for the cut, so it's not worth looking into is how I was going to word that. Since they're not ready for a cut, I'm not going to break down their field. MPO, though, 132 player field. So with 20% assumed loss, that would be 26 players at Idlewild. Which, with a $250 entry fee, that's $6,500 reduction in the MPO purse. I don't think the added cash would change, do you, losing those players at the cut?
Because
I think the added cash is coming in for the top players anyways.
Right. Yeah.
So that would keep the added cash to MPO at $12,800. So the purse would basically change from $45,800 to $39,300. So, without the cut, I took what the payout would be divided by the amount of players paid out, and the average person that made money at that tournament made $864. So on average, it paid out, I think it was 53 players. When you break that down on average, it was $865. If you lose 20% of the field, the average payout actually goes up to $913.95, which was actually pretty surprising to me. So losing 20% of the field actually made the players who were cashing, who actually showed up and ended up in the top half of the field, more money. So obviously me, I was like, how the heck does that make sense? And how it makes sense is that the added cash goes farther now.
Right.
Because the amount you were paying out went from 53 players down to, I believe it was about 43 players.
Right, if you calculate it after the cut.
No, I left it at 40%, the PDGA standard.
Right, but if you're calculating that 40% from after the cut.
Correct.
So that's where
it comes out. Not after the cut. The cut line would be around that.
Oh, you're saying after you take away the players that
you
are
take away
leave
the players
field.
Who are leaving because of the cut.
Right. What if you calculate it after the cut line?
Well, that's not a not a thing. I don't think we're ready for that. But based on 26 players leaving the field,
yeah.
The same 40% cashing, which would lower to about, I think it was 43, it was somewhere in that range, basically from 53 to 43, the added cash can go farther.
Right, yeah.
So you lose their entry fees, but in losing their entry fees, you also don't have to pay out as many places, which means the added cash can actually go farther.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what first place was going to be, but Idyllwild seems to do their own pay scale. They don't use the PDGAs. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard to calculate because they gave last place less money and first place more money, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. But it made it hard for me to do that math. So I wasn't able to see the direct correlation to what first place was going to end up receiving. Because that's what I wanted to see, is like, is this actually increasing first place? But based on the average going up, it obviously would have had to increase what first place was getting as well.
Yeah.
So once I hear that, because I'm going to be honest with you, I was for a cut on the Pro Tour, you know, simply because I thought it would benefit the tour, it would benefit the legitimacy, you know, it would add that little bit more of like a competitive spirit where you can watch the top, but you can also watch the cut line. But my biggest question mark was that money part of, well, is this hurting the purse? Like, mm-hmm. is it really going to be worth it? Because disc golf doesn't have outside money yet.
Yeah.
So we're relying on the players to add into that purse. So that was always a big withdrawal for me, was like, well, can we really afford to lose, let's say, even 30%, 20 to 30% of the field over this? How much is that hurting? And now that I see it, it's not hurting, I'm having a hard time finding cons to this, other than if you look at it on a player level of this specific player might not play in the Pro Tour anymore.
Yeah.
Which, that's not to say he's not going to tour anymore, because I think there's still national tours, A tiers, and local tournaments that you can make a living on until you're good enough to consistently cash on the Pro Tour.
Yeah.
So I think this is a way that kind of implements, not that tour card per se.
It's kind of like the same idea, though. It's encouraging guys to stay off of the
Pro Tour until you're ready.
Until they can actually make cuts.
Yeah. Because that was another thing, is I saw a tweet where it said that this idea of a cut was elitist thinking that turned disc golf exclusive.
It's not exclusive, okay? That whole, like, elitist mindset, and people say, like, well, that's what ball golf, they're elitist. Ball golf is elitist in the sense that getting into the sport is expensive, and it's a country club thing. That's what makes ball golf elitist. But you can't say that being a top player in disc golf is elitist and exclusive, because they've earned that right.
Anyone
through
can get
skill,
there.
Anybody could get there.
Yeah.
Right. It's not like they had some kind of privilege. Like, I mean, they earned it. They worked hard and they got there. So anybody could work their way up to that point.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is I don't think a cut is necessarily exclusive, because there's no rules as to who made the cut, right, other than your score
and
your talent.
And just because we know, they think that because, like, they know who the established players are right now. So they're like, well, we know who's going to be in that cut the whole time. Well, 10 years from now, it's anybody's ball game.
Yeah.
So
it's,
like,
already turning into anybody's,
right,
ball game.
That's what I'm saying. Like, who those players that are in the making the cuts is going to be completely different.
Well, here's my thing, right? Is if you're a player, like, if I'm going to a Pro Tour event,
yeah,
at my skill level, I would legitimately, and I could be crazy for this, I would legitimately believe I have a chance of making the cut. So the cut wouldn't scare me. It would give me a goal.
Right, right.
If you're a player and you don't think you have a legitimate chance of making the cut, you're just kind of going there for the experience anyways. So realistically, like, if you're going and you're on tour and you think you don't have a chance of making the cut, then realistically, you can't afford to be on tour.
If you're doing that, you're a tourist, not a tour player, basically.
Yeah, I mean, then you can't, like, because legitimately, then, like, how are you surviving right now?
Yeah.
If you're going week in and week out, and you're like, well, if there was a cut, I don't know if I could even, you know, that wouldn't make sense for me. Like, are you really relying on rounds 3 and 4 to get you somehow into the cash line?
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
exactly. You're probably out of it by then.
Yeah.
So
that, to me,
use those extra days you just got to look for another event or something.
Or another job. Those, but the 20 or 30 people that we would lose, to me, is the people, honestly, like me, who I'm not going, like, if I'm going to go out and play, like, a Ledgestone or whatever, you know, I'm going for just the experience, the pure experience.
Yeah.
I'm going to play open because I'm hoping I'm playing with some cool guys. but I'm just going out for the experience. I might have a chance at cashing, but I'm not guaranteeing it. I'm not thinking about it. So,
right.
But as soon as I lose 2 days of playing, then my question is, do I really want to drive 12 hours to only play two rounds? My answer would probably be no.
Right.
So you would lose players like me. But again, I think that players like me would only make up like 20% of the field. Mm-hmm. Because I think that the local pros, that whole scenario changes if all of a sudden this is in my backyard at Bedford.
Yeah.
Because now I'm like, well, it's 30 minutes. You know, I might get to play around with Paul or Calvin or whoever round one. And what if, you know, it's my local course. What if I pop off and I make the cut?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that whole idea changes. So that's why I don't actually think this would hurt the field as much as players think it would right now.
I think it just makes it, I think it makes it for more exciting storylines too.
Yeah.
Being able to see guys come from like, you know, guys you haven't heard of and they make a cut. Because now all of a sudden, that player who nobody knows stands out a lot more in a cut field where it's like all the top guys and him.
Yeah, it's so like, wow,
right?
So and so just made the cut. Not only to make a cut, he's 25th place.
Right. So if you make a cut now and you're kind of a nobody yet at this point, then like now people are gonna, you're gonna get recognized
because it creates more storylines, which is the whole thing in disc golf. Is I think we need more storylines. That's when we were talking about a long time ago, drama in disc golf.
Yeah,
and we don't need to like go creating drama and gossiping. But there needs to be storylines because that's just going to draw more people in and get you more invested. You know, I think that's this type of stuff that MMA and UFC, I think that's the type of stuff that makes it so interesting is the stories leading up to the fight.
Yeah.
More so than the fight itself, because there are some fights that only last like 5 seconds. Yeah,
it makes the fight itself way more interesting.
And I think that would make the tournaments way more interesting is it's like, oh, you know, Justin Rozak has made... This is his first year on tour, and he's made 3 of the 4 cuts, you know, on the pro tour. Is this a new up-and-coming player? You know what I mean? Yeah. Or, wow, name a random pro.
Andrew Marweed.
Wow, Andrew Marweed has missed 2 cuts in a row.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It creates more storylines beyond just Paul, Ricky, Eagle, Calvin, Chris, one. You know what I mean? Because that's the biggest storyline right now.
Yeah.
Or if you have someone randomly break into the top 20, this just kind of adds another dimension to that in my eyes. And the more I think about it, the more I think that the advantages greatly outweigh the disadvantages of it. And especially once I did the research on the numbers side, I think that does it too. I wanted to come in here and play devil's advocate and debate with you. But the more I did it and the more I tried to come up with counter arguments, I just... It was a never-ending snowball of like countering it. And then I was like, well, this is a super easy fix.
Yeah.
And on Brody's Twitter, the initial tweet, it was a poll, and it was 75% thought there should be cuts to 25% thought there shouldn't.
Yeah.
At the time I looked at it, it might have changed a little
bit. He's got a lot of those, like, ball golf to disc golf transition fans because of his previous channel. That is true. So they kind of think along the same mindset.
That is true. I don't think in all areas disc golf should try to be like ball golf by any means. I think there's a lot of stuff that we can just leave behind. You know, country club. Only pay to play. I mean, I don't mind pay to play, but I don't want you're paying an arm and a leg to play.
Well, a lot of times they're public parks. That's the thing about disc golf. Yeah. So, like, it's always like a state park is never going to be pay to play.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying is like that type of atmosphere where it is that elitist part of golf.
Yeah.
Where, you know, when you walk onto the country club, like, I've went and played golf rounds before and I'm like, I do not belong here.
Right.
Like, you walk in and everyone's staring at you like, who the heck's this new guy? That, I don't think, ever has room in disc golf by any means.
No.
And I think that when people hear the word golf, that's immediately what they think of. And that's the part of golf I don't want. But I do think there's stuff like this, like the cut and other parts, like their payout scale and stuff like that, that we can implement in disc golf and learn from them. That would be huge. Now, one thing I do want to ask that also comes along with this cut is, do you think that in rounds 1 and 2, they should be playing with the same group? And playing on different times of the day. So basically right now, how disc golf works is round 1 is randomly sorted with the exclusion of feature cards. Mm-hmm. And then round 2 is sorted by score. So in theory, in a place like Emporia, Kansas, where the afternoon's really windy, but the morning might not be, you might have a player, let's just use Calvin. Calvin might tee off at 9 in the morning, and he's playing on a dewy ground, but no wind. And then you have Ricky teeing off at 2 p.m. in crazy winds, but no dew on the ground. So you could see where Calvin might be at a slight advantage because of the no wind. Do you think that they should flip-flop day 2 so that everyone's playing the courses in a generic average baseline?
It's unfortunate because this format works best in a four-round structure because, like in ball golf, you have the first 2 rounds are flip-flopped like that, and then you have moving day where guys can establish their position, and then you have the final round.
So should Pro Tour go to four rounds in general? Maybe we answer that first.
I think three rounds is fine. I don't have a problem with it, but it does. I think it'd be better. I think four rounds would be better.
Like, I think my opinion is if it's one course, three rounds is fine because it's one course. If it's two courses, it needs to be four rounds.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's for sure.
I think that's
for certain.
That's where I think disc golf kind of stands right now.
Yeah,
because I think one round over four, or one course over four rounds could get boring just because we don't have things like changing the pin locations that change the course so much. Because
my thing is with only having, if you do it the way you're talking about, which does make sense. Playing in the same group, exact same group, doesn't necessarily matter as long as you're...
It's just different times.
It's the matter. Different times that
or
matter.
Or the time frames.
Right. So you do want to... It should be like you play... If you play in the morning, you play in the afternoon, and vice versa. But that makes it so you only get to watch one round with a lead card. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Whereas, well, like, that hurts disc golf viewership.
That's the biggest issue with disc golf currently would be the question of the coverage.
Right.
Because then do you follow the feature card 2 days in a row? Do you have two different feature cards?
Yeah.
I think until...
I don't think they can change it.
I don't think disc golf can implement it until they're ready for, like... I mean...
You got to have four rounds.
Yeah, you got to have four rounds. Because then you wouldn't really... So in golf, how do they do it? In golf, how do they cover when they do this?
When they do what?
The like flip-flop thing.
Like what groups they cover?
Mm-hmm.
I think they just... They typically just switch up the... like what the feature cards... I mean, if it's...
Well, so, the thing I guess they're saying round one and two doesn't really matter.
The thing about ball golf is like... Rounds one and two are not watched nearly as much because they're not on the weekend.
As round three and four.
So, like, a lot of people aren't even... They're going to follow the scores, but they're not even going to tune in on Thursday and Friday. A lot of times, for a lot of events, the big networks might not even have coverage.
So, I guess Saturday. By the time Friday comes, they can cover all the cards because the cuts happened.
Right.
So, the window of them teeing off is smaller.
The time Saturday.
Saturday. So, the window of them teeing off so much smaller.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's where they can pretty much follow everybody that's relevant.
So I think that's where disc golf, with the argument for the flip-flopping times, falls apart.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, because even if you're trying to do a live coverage, you can't live stream from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. or I know it wouldn't be 10. 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. That just wouldn't make sense.
It's very tricky.
Yeah. So maybe that doesn't work. I like the idea of it because it balances the field a little bit more. So I like the idea from that perspective, but if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I think until live disc golf is the main way disc golf's being consumed, live coverage, I don't think that'll work.
Yeah.
Which I mean, that maybe that's something we talk about, you know, in an upcoming podcast. The day, I think, will come where live disc golf is the way you consume disc golf. I do think the post-produced will still exist, but it'll kind of be the secondary, whereas right now it's the primary.
Right.
And I think that would kind of restrict the flip-flopping idea. But cuts in general, I mean, it's hard for me to formulate an argument against. If you at home have an argument against it, comment it down below or send us a direct message. If you're listening to this on Spotify or iTunes, send us a direct message on Twitter, Instagram, wherever, and let us know your counter argument, because I would love to kind of hear some more opinions on this. Every argument, like I said, I could come up with or I had heard didn't really make sense the more I broke it down statistically, but I don't want to be naive about it because I'm sure there are good arguments against it. I just don't think that the argument of losing players and hurting the purse really work.
Yeah.
So if there's arguments outside of that, send them to us. We would love to take a look at them. But other than that, it's time to jump over into our next segment, which is Trevor's Trivia. And this time, I normally have like a hint of like what you're at least looking into. This time, I got nothing. I have no idea what I'm about to be asked.
So we are going to do something a little different I came up with. This used to be something in my Sports Illustrated kids magazines that I always loved. They would have like this trivia. And one of the things was What's the Call, which we also do on here. And this one was Who Am I?
Okay.
So I'm going to read off clues. And after each clue, you can make a guess, but only make a guess if it's very much educated.
So I'm trying to guess the player that you're describing.
So I'm going
to
do a male player and then a female player.
Okay.
You only get one guess per clue and only make a guess at all if you have a very educated idea. So first we'll do the male player. So the first clue, I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. I assume that
Nicola Castro.
Is that your guess, or do you want to?
You can keep going.
Okay. My first pro win was in 2006.
I mean, I'm feeling pretty confident, but keep going.
Okay.
Do I get like negative points if I go too far?
No.
Then I want to keep hearing the hints.
Okay. I broke Barry Schultz's season winnings record in 2009 and again in 2010.
I mean, that lines up with the Nico timeline, but I don't know.
Okay. Don't lock in your guess until you're positive.
I'm not locking it in yet.
Okay. You still got some more hints. I have played for more than four manufacturers.
Okay, it's Nico. It's 100% Nico.
I was
as soon as you said St. Louis, I was the only pro I could remember from St. Louis.
So I didn't know if you knew that or not. I was debating. Yeah, 'cause
that's where Gateway's headquarters is, and his uncle or something owns Gateway.
Well, yeah, but I didn't know if you knew that or not. The other hints you would have had after that was I am 3-time player of the year.
That wouldn't have helped me.
That wouldn't have?
No.
See, if I wouldn't have that first hint, if it wouldn't have got it there, you probably would have been a little stuck.
No, the multiple manufacturers I think would have gotten.
Probably.
Because there's not a lot of players that jump around that much in that timeline.
So that one I knew was going to be pretty easy, but this one's going to be difficult. I'm almost positive in that. So this is a female player.
Okay.
So I have 80 career wins for over $50,000 in earnings for the career.
Okay.
My PDGA number is 33833.
Okay.
Obviously, you're not supposed to know whose number is that, but like you
Trina Allen, I think.
You get the idea. My best finish on the Pro Tour this season was third.
Not Katrina Allen, then?
My first FPO win was in 2010. Best season.
Who didn't have a Pro Tour win this year?
I was born in Emporia, Kansas.
Paige Bierkus. Paige Shue.
Yep, there it is. The next thing would have been, I'm a world champion, and the one after that would have been, I've never won Player of the Year, and that would have given it to you.
No, the Player of the Year wouldn't have known. I would assume she would have won it when she won Worlds.
It throws you off because...
She had 80 wins.
Yeah.
Holy.
What throws you off the most is because her PDGA number is so old. 33833 is ancient.
Not really. Paul's is 27523.
For a lot of the female players, it's pretty old.
I feel like Paige's is older than that.
Well, Paige is significantly older in general.
Yeah. When you said 80 wins, when you started with that, I was thinking like Elaine
King. Elaine King's got like 500 wins.
Yeah, I realized that. I realize that now that you said who it was, but like that just seemed like insurmountable amount of wins.
I knew
of
if
wins.
I read that to you, you'd be like, it sounded big, even
it
though
sounds
it's not
huge.
Really.
Yeah, and so I was immediately thinking like some of the like Hall of Fame players.
Yeah, I figured.
And then when you gave me the PDGA number, when you said 33, I was expecting like 47.
Yeah.
And then you gave me another 3, I'm like, oh gosh.
All right, that one's a little bit better.
Without Kansas, I wouldn't have guessed it.
Yeah, that was another one where I'm surprised you knew.
Kansas. Emporia, Kansas. That's impressive. Discs.
The more you know, Hunter Thomas is very adept at knowing the birthplace of his golfers.
I would have known that was her birthplace. I just knew she was from there, if that makes any sense. Might not make sense.
Impressive.
So before we get into our final segment of Make That Call, I want to touch on... the PDGA Player of the Year standings.
It's bad.
They released them, and I don't want to judge it too hard because they made a lot of changes due to COVID.
Yeah.
One change I didn't see, but maybe I overlooked it, but when we were talking to Paul about it, it seems like normally they had a restriction on the amount of A tiers they counted.
Mm-hmm.
They
took it off.
It doesn't seem like that's there this year, but I'm wondering if it's because of this. I'm wondering if this is like the way around it, is they made Pro Tour... have national tour level points.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that's why like the 10 A tier restrictions still in, but since the pro tours are no longer A tiers, they're considered national tours for this. Maybe that's where that came in.
Yeah. Sure.
I should have, after Paul said it, you know, today, I should have looked into it a little bit more after that. But regardless, I think that this in general shows a few issues with the system overall. And then it shows a lot of issues with the system, specifically this year for COVID,
mm-hmm.
which, again, I want to mention the PDGA did change the system for COVID to try to allow it to be a more legitimate system for this year. I think they failed in that because it basically, if you played a lot of A tiers, you won Player of the Year.
I mean, they should be able to just, I mean, we'll talk about the standings here in a second, but if you should be able to just look at, hear these standings and regardless of what you, like the people that we thought like were, you could argue for Player of the Year over Paul, like aren't even the top two.
Well, I don't think MPO, I'm not super upset about.
You are out of your mind.
Okay, well let's go to MPO first then.
It's shocking.
MPO, Chris Dickerson leads. And then it goes Ricky Wysocki second.
Yeah.
Paul third. And I believe Calvin was fourth. But so bad. It goes Chris, basically Ricky, backwards. Paul. But I don't have an issue with Chris, is my thing.
You should.
I don't think that Ricky should be second.
Just because he won a major.
Well, my thing is, when we talked about Player of the Year, I had said Paul, Chris, Calvin.
No, Calvin has to be second.
No, not in that order. I'm just saying those three players. Because I was debating between Paul and Calvin mainly.
I think Paul and Calvin. But
I thought that Chris's name, I thought Chris's name could be in the mix. I thought it could. I'm not too upset about just the fact that Chris Dickerson's leading Player of the Year. That doesn't upset me that much. I don't like A, how much he's leading, and B, the reason he's leading, which is simply because he went and played a lot of A tiers and won a lot of A tiers.
Right.
So it has nothing to do.
That's the important.
No other big players.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's fine that he won a bunch of A tiers, but like, it would be different if those A tiers were where all the big players were there. There weren't.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying is like, it's not like it's based solely on when he was competing with the rest of the people that are competing with him. And that's the reason Ricky's beating Paul as well, is because Paul doesn't,
even worse.
And Eagle's even way farther down there because Eagle, Paul, and Calvin didn't really play any A tiers outside of the Pro Tour. Eagle didn't even play all the Pro Tour events.
Yeah.
So Eagle's even farther down the list, which is also criminal to me.
Yeah, I think Paul had like 14 and Eagle had like 11 Elite Series events or something.
Something like that. I want to say Eagle's in like 7th.
Yeah.
It was somewhere way down there. Which is so bad
because he could be argued for first.
That's what I'm saying. He could be argued. He could also be thrown into that argument for Player of the Year based on stats and performance. But when you put points into it, it just puts so much weight on how many events you're playing, which is where Chris takes the lead. Where this really falls apart is when you flip over to FPO, which we have Katrina Allen beating Paige Pierce.
Yeah. Very key statistic. We heard this and we saw it and we were like, that can't be right. And then we looked it up and you probably have it written down there.
But I do.
It was what? Katrina beat Paige 3 out of how many times?
Out of 11.
Out of 11
times. They faced off 11 times this year. And Paige Pierce beat her, might not have won, but beat her in the event 8 of those 11. And Kat only beat her 3 times this year.
And Paige had more wins, too. It's not like, oh, that was the head-to-head, but then Kat had, like, more wins. No.
Yeah. Kat had probably more overall wins because she played 8 years.
Yeah, and we're talking about those things that matter.
She led by a lot.
Yeah.
Like, a whole lot, I think.
Yeah, which is so bad.
So, this is where I think it all falls apart. And I think it's mainly because of COVID, because it hasn't been this criminal in the past.
Right.
It's never been this bad.
It's just the points are being weighed very much incorrectly.
Well, it's not so much they're being weighed incorrectly, because a win for an A tier is only like 5 points, but it's the fact that there's not a lot of events this year. To me, A tier shouldn't have counted.
Yeah.
This year. Personally, I for Player of the Year, for Rookie of the Year, yeah, because you got to be looking at all rookies.
Right. Yeah.
But for Player of the Year, I don't see why we're counting the Hub City Halloween Classic or whatever it is, these random A tiers that no one other than, you know, 3 or 4 top tier players are going to. Why is that counting?
In a normal year without COVID, we should have Elite Series schedules that pretty much mean that a pro player might play 1 or 2, maybe 3 A tiers in a year.
Yeah.
Like, they should be busy enough with the big events that everybody's
going to
be
at. They're not going to these obscure random A tiers.
Because, like, I mean, this year, like, they had to, like, Chris Dickerson, dude just likes to play disc golf, and he plays all those stuff around Tennessee and Virginia and whatnot. So, like, it's not a problem that he's playing them. It's just it's a problem the way the points were weighed. I mean, the biggest crime, Chris did have a good season, but, like, the fact that, like, if take away his USDGC win and all of a sudden Ricky wins Play of the Year, how on earth does that work? Like,
yeah.
That would be so bad.
I'm not that upset at the MPO side simply because it's Chris winning. If it was Ricky winning, I think that would be another thing of, like, how is Ricky beating Calvin, Paul, Chris, and Eagle? But with Chris, you know, Chris is someone who I think had to be in contention anyways.
You know, one win.
Maybe not points-wise, but statistics-wise. He's always up there. I feel like I could be wrong there. I didn't look at all the statistics, but when we talked about Player of the Year,
he was
for the Foundation Awards.
He was
awards,
a good bit behind Paul and Calvin, though.
But he was up there.
I mean, at least, he was top three.
Exactly.
But that's like top three when Ricky and Paul are both 40 under, and then the next guy's 22 under.
Okay, it's not that drastic, but I mean,
that's what it felt like.
But I'm saying that on FPO,
you're right. It's more of a.
There's no argument for Cat over Page. There's not one.
That's what I'm saying. If you're the PDGA, how are you not looking at that and being like, well, that's not right? It's like if you compute some kind of like Excel equation for like an assignment and you hit enter and you're like, that can't be right. Like, that shouldn't be like that. Yeah.
I don't know how. Maybe they like just were like, oh, this is a great idea. Let's do this. And then they released it without actually looking at the list.
Or maybe
they don't care about the list. Maybe they're just saying, yeah, this is how it's going to be this year, and whoever wins it based on these, you know, oh, well, Paul and Eagle and Calvin and Paige should have played more A-tiers.
Could you imagine if, like, the NBA gave, like, an MVP out? This like some I don't even know what the equivalent is, but, like, that'd be, like, some guy that just, like, has no business. Like,
it would literally be like golf. Well, golf's the easiest one. If Tiger Woods had an incredible season, Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas.
My golfer's getting named. Here he goes.
How many can I do? They all had incredible season, and then Sergio, whoever, what's his name?
Garcia.
Sergio Garcia wins Player of the Year without winning a single PGA Tour event, but because he played a lot of local events at his golf club, he got Player of the Year. And they're like, well, I'm sorry, Tiger. You should have went to your little country club and played a little more.
That's a bit extreme, but I mean, yeah. But you see what I'm saying. That's the point. Like, Chris Dickerson is not going to go.
Sergio Garcia playing on the web.com tour shouldn't count towards his player of the year.
I mean, the bottom line is Chris Dickerson's not going to go to an A tier. The dude is like a top five player in the world. He's not going to go to an A tier with no other of those top 20 and guys lose. There and lose. He's going to win because he's amazing.
And it's nothing against Chris Dickerson because the dude wants to play golf.
Like, yeah,
go play golf. But it's just that shouldn't count towards this year's player of the year. If they want to in general,
what if they made what if there was like a rule where like the field had to have like the top certain amount of players in the field, their ratings had to add up to a certain amount?
No.
It would work though.
It wouldn't because it might. Yeah, but it would. I just don't like anything where we bring ratings into it, because then that just brings up more issues of like
I'm just trying to think of a way that you, because like there are A tiers sometimes, like let's say when the Memorial's an A tier and like people do show up to it, then we'd be like, well, the Memorial counted.
Yeah.
Like, there's no other way to really count it other than with ratings. You'd have to say, like, the top 10 players had to have a rating.
No, it just would have to be on the National Tour or the Pro Tour.
Well, it's not going to be.
Well, then that's too bad. It's not going to count towards Player of the Year.
I mean, I'm fine with that.
To me, that's the simple defining line.
It's the easiest way to do it.
For this year. I think once there's more events and enough events that the little A tiers, 5 points here and there doesn't matter because there's enough Pro Tours and stuff to cover up, then who cares?
Yeah.
But I do want to bring up the question of, with the flaw that was just revealed mainly by Katrina Allen winning Player of the Year this year. She's a great player, but she did not beat Paige this year for Player of the Year. I don't think, I would be shocked if someone in the comments could argue that point. I don't know how anyone could. The flaw that was raised by that, what in your opinion, and I'll give my opinion too, would be the remedy for this? What would be a restructuring going forward for the future Player of the Years? Is it still points, or is it some other structure?
No, Player of the Year should be voting. That's how they do MVPs in other sports.
Voting by who? Not in other sports, in disc golf. Who would be the one voting?
Right. So I think it's tough. I don't know. You're talking about like Hall of Fame votes and things like that. There's like panels of people that do. There's like committees. So you could have a committee, but I don't even know who I'd put on that committee and who wouldn't be biased. I feel like there's so much bias in disc golf. There's so much bias. I mean, people are going to be like, yeah, no kidding. You guys talk about Paul every second, like whatever, but there's a lot of bias in disc golf. So I think voting does make it difficult, but it eliminates confusing numbers like this, like a flaw in their number system, basically. Now, I think the easiest way to do it is just not count A tiers. Only Elite Series stuff counts.
And just do points still.
Right? Yeah. That's fine with me. But like voting is a good way to do it. There's a reason they do it in other sports, because sometimes there are narratives that go beyond numbers, basically. And that's why they do it that way. Like the Heisman Trophy for college football, that's voting. Doesn't have to do with numbers.
Well, I think in team sports, it's different because if LeBron James goes off and the Lakers still suck, he might still be able to be Player of the Year.
That's true. It is a bit more objective in
whereas
golf.
Whereas in disc golf,
because you're playing for yourself.
Yeah, if you go off,
your numbers speak for themselves.
It's pretty simple. So to me, I think that the easiest way to remove bias is strictly make it statistical.
The only thing that does go against that is like how much you weigh certain wins, like how much you would weigh a major. Like, that's like how, almost how you argue Dickerson for player of the year, is because, like, yeah, he didn't have a ton of wins, but he won the USDGC, and that's super heavy. And I guess you could just weigh it differently in points, but, like,
I think this is what you do. I think you have a minimum tournament requirement of National Tour, Pro Tour, and majors to qualify yourself for player of the year. I think there's a minimum tournament across all of those. And then National Tours, National Tour average finish, Pro Tour average finish, and major average finish are all systemized to where, or you look at the average. So, you know, if Paul's is 3 in Pro Tours, 7 in National Tours, and 2 in majors, then you weight, then you put the weight on that. So maybe the major makes up 50% and the other two make up 25% and 25% or something along those lines. You run the math. Whoever statistically was the best player that year gets player of the year, period.
I'm fine with that.
And then as long as they met this threshold, you know, you can even do drops if you wanted it to be, you have 10 events and the 10 events that give you the best portfolio, those 10 are the ones we take. I don't know. Maybe that's not a good idea. I do think there needs to be an event minimum so that you don't have a player showing up to one Pro Tour, one National Tour, and one major, winning all three, and then be like, oh, right.
Use average.
Yeah.
For,
well, I think you use average, but I think it needs to be,
if there was no minimum set.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a minimum for that average. And I think that, but just makes
that
the most sense.
You probably would have to use drops, because if you've got guys that play 20 events going against 10.
Yeah, so maybe the drop is 15.
Right.
You know, I think 10's probably too small, but I don't know. Your 10 best finishes.
I just feel like most years, though, it shouldn't even be that hard to figure out what player of the year was. This year was
most
pretty...
Most year points tell the story well.
Yeah. Well, in this year, most years, you can just, like, literally think about it, and it's pretty easy. Like, oh, this guy won this. Like, it's getting way tighter in disc golf, and this was, like, one of the tightest seasons yet as far as, like, guys being all over the place. But, like, I mean... It wasn't hard from 2012 to 2015. It sure wasn't hard to figure out who player of the year was.
Well, I think that's why this year I don't have an issue with Chris Dickerson. Like, if this ends up standing and whatever, and he wins player of the year, I have no problem with it, because he had a heck of a year. He, you know, won USDGC. He performed well at pretty much most tournaments I remember he performed well in. I don't have an issue with that. I do have an issue with Katrina Allen. I don't think in the history book you should look at 2020 and see Katrina Allen player of the year,
right,
when there's a player that beat her 8 of the 11 times they faced.
Yeah, that hurts.
Like, that makes no sense to me, to go 8-3 in Pro Tour and, like, big events against her, and then you don't get player of the year. That, I think that's criminal. I think that the PDGA is robbing Paige Pierce of a rightful player of the year, and I would bet you Katrina Allen would even admit it.
Yeah.
I think it would be...
Maybe.
If I was Katrina Allen, I would have a hard time accepting that award.
Yeah, I wouldn't want it if I didn't feel like I'd earned it, but...
Yeah. I mean, I could be wrong there, but... I don't know. Let us know again what you think of this current Player of the Year standings. Should the PDGA change it? And if they do change it, what format should they go to? Again, DM us on any of our social media or comment in the comment section down below. And we're going to head into our final segment, which is Make That Call. And... I've got a little bit of a spicy one for you here, Trevor.
Ooh.
I'm pretty proud of this one.
Okay.
Normally when I'm reading it, I'll be like, oh, I got to look up Make That Call. And then I'll be like, oh, so Trevor knows, like, oh, this is something Hunter didn't know. I didn't do it this time.
Mm.
So you don't know what I'm about to say.
No, I don't.
All right. So in a tournament.
Yeah.
Your card reaches a hole that's the shape of a horseshoe. So just to paint the picture for you, right?
I feel like we've had like 3 of these.
This is your tee and the basket is directly to the right. Okay, well, but
last
in between,
time it was directly to the left.
This one's to the right. We're okay. Switching it up. It's a par 4, though, and in between you, there's trees here, and it's a full horseshoe. So it's a par 4 because you have to throw like a 300-foot shot, 300-foot shot, 300-foot shot. No, but you're up against a tree line, so there's no way from the tee to go up and over,
or through. Okay.
I mean, you could try going through, but good luck. It's tight.
I'm doing it.
But... All right. So you step up to the hole, shape of a horseshoe, tees up against a tree line. Plays the par 4, you have to go out and around, get to the basket. Player on your card declares, hey, I'm going to take optional relief from the tee. Walks 100 feet out to the left, which is away from the basket, then proceeds to throw up and over the trees and parks the basket. Okay. If he makes that putt, what is his score?
Optional relief. I'm not very well versed in optional relief from the tee pad. I don't know if I've ever heard of that. I know that there's some events where you're allowed to throw from the side of the tee pad, but I've never heard of optional relief from the tee pad.
What? Optional relief in general.
Optional relief. I've never even heard of that rule. I know you can get relief from hazards. And he obviously didn't get closer to the hole. But that seems like he just picked out his custom tee pad.
So what's his final score?
It has to be. Well, it can't. If he used a term like optional release, I doubt it's a misplay. But it has to be a stroke. I'm saying he takes a three.
Correct.
That's a guess, though. So, I don't know the rule. That's just my best guess.
So you brought up a good point of the tee pad, because I'd have to look into the rest of the rule.
Oh boy,
to make sure there's not a restriction on it being a tee pad.
There has to be.
I don't think there is.
You gotta be kidding me. There's no way.
So it's according to rule 803.02E. So basically it's stating that as long as you're taking optional relief away from the basket, you can do that at any point with a one penalty throw.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So at any point,
you can be in jail and you can be like, I'm just going to get a little further, get to this gap, mm-hmm. and take a stroke when you're like, it's going to take me at least two strokes.
As long as you're going directly away from the basket.
That's amazing.
It's the same exact rule that allows you to take.
I feel like the rule when you take the would OB have relief, T-pad in there if it wasn't.
When you take the OB relief, it's the same rule that allows you to take that on that line of the basket as far back as you want. It's the exact same rule.
That is
you can,
stupid.
That rule is in play at all times, but the only time you don't get a stroke is if you already got a stroke off the OB.
Why does it exist, though?
You know, I don't know.
To get away from a beehive, maybe? Things of that nature?
But if it's an unplayable lie, you can take relief without a stroke. I'm not entirely certain why optional relief exists with a stroke at any point.
That is fascinating.
But it does. 802.03. Second
I would be
E.
shocked if you could take it off of a tee pad, just because a tee pad should be established that you don't need to take relief from a tee pad. Like, it should be a good place to throw.
But it's optional. I don't know. I'll have to look at the rule, because, again, I read you that sure and I immediately would. Was like, oh, well, what if you did this? Oh, well, what if it was off the tee and you did this? And I, like, immediately made up this whole scenario that I just gave
Impressive
you.
Impressive scenario.
And but now I'm like, well, frick.
Fascinating rule, because I'd never heard of it.
If I messed up and you're listening to this on Spotify, check the description. I'll put that I messed up.
Still interesting.
Or check the pinned comment.
Because I didn't know
that. And I'll say I messed up. If there's nothing in the pinned comment or the description, it means that I was right and you can't do it off the tee pad. I don't know. Yeah. I feel like you shouldn't be able to, but the more I think about it, the more I feel like you can. But optional relief is a rule in general, regardless of,
interesting,
you know, whether it may or may not be off the tee pad. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting one that I thought just might stump you.
I didn't know the rule, so.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for this week's podcast. Hopefully you guys enjoyed. I do want to give a quick shout out that we got all of our apparel in.
Yeah, what are we wearing right now?
Yeah, so I'm wearing a little sneak peek hoodie. I won't show you what's on the back, but there is something on the back. And Trevor's wearing our rain jacket, our first ever foundation rain jacket. We've had some Supreme Flight ones before.
Very lightweight.
Yeah, we tested it out because when it came in, it was so lightweight that we thought, oh, frick. It might have messed up the waterproof.
Very waterproof.
We took it outside and literally ran it under a hose while wearing it. A lot of water. Not a drop got through. No. I was very surprised. Yeah. So it's a half zip. These will all be dropping soon. Marketing stuff will be coming out on our Instagram and all of that, showing you the full range of fall/winter apparel that we have, plus announcing the release date. So be sure you're staying tuned to all of that. But here's a little a sneak peek for those of you who tune into the podcast. And if you're not watching the podcast, if you're just listening to it, just imagine like the sickest hoodie with a foundation logo and a very nice rain jacket with a foundation logo. And there you go. I've spoken into existence in your mind. Yes. But again, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. However you're doing it. If you're listening to us on iTunes, be sure to leave us a review. We read all of those. We really, really appreciate it. I think we're at 117 right now. Let's get it up to 130 after this episode. So let's get 13 reviews from this episode. I'd really appreciate it. Whether you love us, whether you hate us, I want to hear your feedback in general. I think it really helps us kind of tune this show to exactly what you want. Someone's going crazy above us. I don't know if you can hear that, but I think it's time to wrap it up. So unless Trevor has anything else.
No. Get ready for the apparel drop.
Yeah. So that's going to be it. We will talk to you guys next week.